In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Climate Power Executive Director Lori Lotus and Heritage Foundation Senior Research Fellow Jack Spencer discuss the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act on clean energy job creation. Then, University of Houston political science professor Brandon Rottinghouse discusses his new study that found scandals don't have the impact on politicians like they used to. Plus, Gabe Rotman of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press discusses that recent police raid on a small-town Kansas newspaper and broader concerns over press freedom in the U.S.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
First, a discussion about green jobs on this one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act.
To talk about clean energy job creation in the IRA, we're joined in studio this morning by Jack Spencer, Senior Research Fellow on Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and Lori Lotus, Executive Director of the research firm Climate Power. Lori Lotus joining us via Zoom this morning. The first question for you, your group has tried to put a number on green job creation since the IRA was signed into law. What do you think that number is?
Sure. So since the Inflation Reduction Act passed a year ago, companies have announced over 170,000 jobs all across the country. These are not just jobs going to one coast or another. They're in zip codes all over the place in my home state of Oklahoma, in Georgia. And these are jobs that are good paying jobs that are rebuilding our country. This manufacturing boom is really, I think, taking a lot of people by surprise, but it's really welcome news. It's strengthening our economy and it's helping grow the middle class. And it's really helping us get out of the inflation, in the economic woes that we had been facing for the last couple of years. So it's really exciting what's happening because of the Inflation Reduction Act.
How do we define a green job?
You know, it's jobs that are in wind and solar, geothermal. So these are everything from construction jobs to manufacturing jobs to support staff and everything in between. So you're seeing a lot of job creation in the battery sector from Georgia all the way up to through Michigan. And these are producing EV batteries, for instance. There's also offshore wind. We saw the announcement that you just played from the president where they're manufacturing the wind turbines that will be used for offshore wind production. And so the ramp up in energy and the ramp up in clean energy is really something that we should all be proud of because it really is made in America clean energy. And we're now able to produce more energy here at home, which is a great thing.
Jack Spencer, you've been tracking this as well at the Heritage Foundation, also using the term boom that we heard Lori Lotus say in a recent column. You say the green manufacturing boom is going to lead to a dangerous bust. Explain why.
Yeah, it's not surprising that you have a lot of this job creation happening because you have a government who is funneling all sorts of subsidies towards certain types of energy, at the same time limiting the options that consumers have on the energy side. And layered on top of that, you have a president who literally, as a plank of his presidential platform, wants to put up an entire sector out of business. So, yes, it's true. Whenever you put those things together.
You're talking about the oil and gas.
Yeah, the hydrocarbon industry. When you put those things together, you're going to have this sort of economic activity. The problem is that it's not being driven by consumer demand. I would argue it's largely a house of cards. It's dependent on policy. What we need to build a strong manufacturing economy is having a tax structure business environment that allows consumer demand, consumer preference to drive economic activity.
You talk about all sorts of subsidies. Can you put a dollar amount on what we know in the past year that has gone to the creation of green jobs?
Well, we know what's in the IRA is almost $400 billion. Subsequent analyses show that that's going to be almost three times, perhaps more than that, from the tax subsidy standpoint. So it's literally hundreds of billions of dollars going to these industries.
Lori,
that's in addition to, remember, they are the government policy and regulation is limiting the choice that consumers have. So it's both sides driving this.
Lori Lotus, once the subsidies, as Jack describes them, once the provisions of the IRA run out, how do we know that these jobs are still going to be there, that there will be demand for these jobs?
I mean, what's incredible about the President Biden's clean energy plan is it gives corporations, it gives the private sector the confidence they need, the certainty they need to invest. And that's what's happening right now is companies have announced over 200 projects all across the country, investing $270 billion into local communities, right? So this is anything but a house of cards. What it is ramping up clean energy production that we know we need to have. We cannot continue to be reliant only on the foreign oil market, setting prices and allowing oil and gas companies to price gouge us without using the wind and the sun that we have right here at home. The thing that Jack said that I think is important to reflect on is that this is not just a matter of business. This is about people's lives. Right now, we have a situation in Hawaii where 99 people have been killed because of the worsening climate crisis. We have a grid in Texas that would have collapsed if it was not for the wind and solar that has come online and that kept the prices down for people. We have water off the coast of Florida that's over 100 degrees. We cannot ignore the climate crisis. It's why the president calls it the crisis of our lifetime, because we have to act. And what I think I hear Jack saying is that we shouldn't be doing anything, which to me is just not, that's a non-starter. We have to take action. In this way, we are creating jobs. It's a huge opportunity, and we're helping to bring costs down and lower pollution, which means cleaner air and cleaner water.
Let me give Jack Spencer a chance to respond.
There's at least 1 million things in that, what Lori just said, that I would like to respond to. I wasn't writing them all down, so let me just hit on a couple. First, I'm not saying we don't do anything. I'm saying that public policy should set an environment where our energy companies can develop affordable, clean energy for consumers, and that those decisions should be made by individual Americans, not by special interests and politicians and bureaucrats. So I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything. I'm saying that we, the American people, should drive this forward. Secondly,
all of those things,
let's just take for granted, which I don't, but for the sake of this conversation, let's take for granted that what Lori described as a climate crisis is in fact a crisis. Absolutely nothing in the IRA would have any impact on that. Using the models that the climate alarmists use to determine such things show that the United States could have zero carbon emissions, and it would have a 0.2 degrees Celsius impact over 100 years. That's using their models. So it is about people, and it's not fair to say that prices are coming down. Electricity prices are going up. Gas and oil is going up. Inflation continues to be part of this economy.
That was Jack Spencer, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Lori Lotus, Executive Director of the advocacy group Climate Power. Next, a deep dive into a new academic study about political scandals.
University of Houston political science professor Brandon Brodinghouse joins us now. His research interest over the years has been the political scandal and the question that he keeps returning to over time. Do scandals still matter when it comes to a politician's career, the minds of voters? Professor Brodinghouse, in American politics in the year 2023, do scandals still matter?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think pertinent because we often use scandals as a way to be able to treat accountability and to be able to frame a political system that sometimes voters don't get a chance to say directly and definitively how the process should go. And so having a scandal is in some ways quite good because it does expose these kinds of problems and does often make the leadership in government change things to make it so that these things can't happen again. On the question of whether scandals still matter, it's an evolving story, and that's what makes it so fascinating. I came of age politically during the Clinton administration, which dates me, but was a perfect time to come of age politically because you get a sense of how it is that the system works, how polarization was just creeping in, and how politicians were just beginning to understand how to deal with scandals. And so I came to this question organically as a curiosity about the way that accountability functions and the way that polarization was a big part of that.
You talk about accountability. Is the way to determine whether a scandal matters determined by whether a politician is driven from office by said scandal?
Yeah, partly that's true. I mean, if it's a kind of egregious enough wrongdoing, then it's certainly something that needs to be handled by the system. Sometimes voters don't have a say because of the way elections are punctuated throughout the timing. And so it's not always the case that voters can decide to, you know, throw the bums out, as it were. You have to have systems in place that prevent that. And so scandals are kind of a canary in the coal mine. It gives you a sense of how it is that the system is functioning. And then as a result, then you've got these laws that can effectively encourage accountability and require the system to adjust to these kinds of events.
What kind of political scandals are more survivable than others?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The best way to survive a scandal is to, frankly, be an elected official. What I do in this work is I look at politicians from the top to more or less the middle. So basically looking at governors and presidents and members of Congress, oftentimes their staff and cabinet members for the executive offices like governors and presidents. And what I find is that if you're the governor, if you're the president, you're very unlikely to lose your position as a result of scandal. Oftentimes you see the underlings falling on the sword, so to speak, and that'll take care of it. So being the elected official oftentimes is pretty good. Being a senator as opposed to being a House member is one way you can survive. Having the scandal be a political scandal or a financial scandal often is better than having it be a personal scandal. Personal scandals over time do tend to be the more damaging. They also obviously tend to be the ones that violate some unwritten norm, and so as a result, they tend to be more dramatic. But the single best way to survive scandal to have more allies, have more friends. It was like Huey Long said, you know, if you've got a friend, you've got a vote. That really works for scandals, too. Governors and presidents, when they've got more support in the legislature, they're able to survive more.
What about after a scandal breaks? In this age of social media, rapid moving news stories that 24 hours later, it's a completely different news cycle. Is a matter of surviving the first few days or even hours of a scandal?
Yeah, how you react initially really does give us a signal as to what the scandal is going to be like. We do see a lot of stonewalling nowadays. We see politicians pivoting to calling these things a witch hunt on a day where our former president was indicted for the fourth time. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of this swirl around the news. That's something that does tend to indicate that there is some actual wrongdoing. The scholarship on this is pretty clear. And one of the things that's interesting is that we do see more stonewalling when you have the scandal be potentially more politically damaging, or when there's divided government. And so there are moments where there's such political friction that the politicians involved see the only way out is effectively to lie or to obfuscate.
You mentioned the former president. What's your read of Hunter Biden and the scandals that Republicans have pointed to when it comes to Hunter Biden?
Yeah, we've seen this before. You know, the president's family has been part of kind of a scandal apparatus going all the way back to Jimmy Carter, and in some cases before Billy Carter, obviously traded on his brother's famous name. You had Roger Clinton doing the same for his brother Bill Clinton. So it's not uncommon to see this kind of political relationship evolve into something that on the business end of things can be problematic for the incumbent. In the terms of the specifics, I think it's definitely troublesome for the Democrats who wanted to put this behind them. It looked like they were going to get that. But now they're going to fight out the scandal during an election, which is always something that's dicey. And although scandals, like I find in this research, don't hit like they used to, they don't have the same tremendously debilitating impact, it's still the case that it can have negative consequences because it kicks you off message. And that's something that when you're running for president and you're trying to win the day's news, makes it much harder to do.
Professor Ridinghouse, we mentioned that you've been researching this over the years, and you write about it in your most recent report, the Trump effect, how the Trump administration has changed your outlook on this. What did you find?
In principle, there is this theory that suggested that Donald Trump changed the way that political scandals affected American politics, largely by essentially letting people get away with things. We saw this in Andrew Cuomo. We see it in George Santos. So there are pieces of evidence that suggest that that's true. If we look at this collectively, though, what I find essentially is that there is a slight effect for modern scandals where they don't have the same negative impact on politicians that they used to. So there's a minor Trump effect, but it depends a lot on which level of government you look at. So by virtue of being able to look at scandals from the 70s to the present at every level of government, that's at the executive level and legislative level, we can get a clearer sense of this. And one of the things we find is that essentially the scandals used to be more problematic before than they are now. So in a pre-polarized era, for instance, during the 1970s, just following Watergate, members of Congress were very likely to lose their seats if they were involved in scandals. But that effect dissipates over time. But we see a strange effect, too, where members of the executive branch are more likely to be hit negatively by scandals during the 1990s and during the Trump era, effectively. So there is a sort of change in effect, but it depends on who you are and where you represent. And so those things are definitely meaningful in terms of how we assess what effect President Trump had on the world. And I have to say, I don't think that Trump is to blame for these things. I think what's happening is that this is a gradual process, which beginning in the mid-1990s became something where the political world changed. It wasn't so much that the rules changed. It was just that the norms around those rules changed. So, for instance, now we have a world where people live in their own media ecosystems. We have a world where people don't trust the media like they used to. We have partisanship rising. So all these things are contributing to this moment where scandals don't hit as much as they used to. The effect isn't terribly strong, but I think if we extend the period for longer, we'll see it more effective.
You mentioned briefly New York Congressman George Santos. Can you just dive a little bit more into your thoughts on his term as a congressman and how the multiple issues have unfolded since he became a congressman?
Yeah, we've seen a rather stunning sort of change in terms of how politicians are able to get away with certain kinds of lies. In this case, obviously, there are a bunch of things that has cascaded towards a particularly troublesome political term for the representative. But it is unusual to see it happen that much. And I guess the question is whether or not this is the signal or this is the noise. And I think largely this is an outlier in terms of how this process goes. And I think the same could be said of President Trump. The fact that these scandals tend to be dominant in the news cycle and tend to, you know, suck up all the oxygen politically from the administration and from the election does suggest that, you know, they're unique in that. So I don't think we're used to seeing quite this much. But that is not to, you know, suggest that these aren't important or that they don't tell us something about the system, because they definitely do. Surviving these things is getting harder and harder. And I think the more of these things that happen and just the volume of the degree of challenge is certainly something that a lot of politicians are going to be curiously watching.
That was Brandon Ridinghouse, political science professor at the University of Houston. Next, a small newspaper in Kansas is at the center of a First Amendment fight after police raided its newsroom last week. We discuss what happened and why it's important with Gabe Rotman of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press.
This is the Marion County Record, and their headline, "Seized but not silenced." A police raid on their newsroom last Friday occurred. Why?
Well, we still don't have all of the facts yet, but the bottom line is it shouldn't have occurred in the first place. Depending on the facts as they come out, the fact is that a newsroom search is the most intrusive investigative step that law enforcement can take. With respect to the press, it really does two things. it shuts down reporting entirely. You know, luckily in this case, there was a huge outpouring of support for the paper and they were able to continue operations. But without that, they would have been dead in the water. And then the other thing it does is it sends a message to others who may want to, who may have information in the public interest, may want to tell that information to journalists either at this outlet or to other media in Kansas, and they're going to be chilled from doing that. So again, you know, we're still trying to figure out exactly why this happened, but what we know for sure is it shouldn't have happened in the first place.
But a judge, local judge, issued an affidavit, a warrant authorizing the police to seize the newspaper's files.
Right. And let me put it this way. On a federal level, these things are so sensitive that the attorney general must personally sign off on any search of the premises of a news entity. So there was a magistrate judge who had a probable cause affidavit, issued the warrant. Although one data point on this is that the county attorney, after reviewing the papers, determined yesterday that there wasn't a legally sufficient nexus between the crimes that were being investigated and both where was searched and the items that they seized as part of the search. In other words, the search shouldn't have happened, even as a legal matter.
And the result was, according to the most recent headline this morning from the Marion County Record, newspaper equipment returned. Their computers, their cell phones were returned to them after, you say, this county attorney general issued this statement. So what happens now?
So a couple things. The attorney who's representing the paper, Bernie Rhodes in Kansas City, has said that he has commissioned a forensic search of the items that were returned to ensure that they hadn't been accessed by police. And if they had been accessed by police, right, that could compromise, you know, not just reporting on the story that may have, you know, led to this incident, but, you know, other stories that they're working on more broadly. And then there's also the legal show is not necessarily over, depending on what they decide to do.
Over the weekend, the Reporters Committee authored a letter along with 30 other media organizations to condemn the raid. In that letter, you write, the search warrant directed at the Marion County Record was significantly overbroad, improperly intrusive, and possibly in violation of federal law. What laws?
So there are a couple, but the main one is called the Privacy Protection Act of 1980. And it significantly limits the ability of law enforcement at all levels, so state, including state and local, to execute search warrants at places where journalism is taking place. And with respect to what's called work product, which you could think of as draft articles or anything that has the mental impressions of a reporter, that's pretty much barred unless the reporter or the news organization is suspected of a crime or there's a significant threat to human life or safety. And then there's documentary material, which is pretty much everything else, right? So raw footage, documents that you receive from a source. And all of that, you have to go and get a subpoena first. So it creates a subpoena first rule, which does two crucial things. One, the news organization has an opportunity to potentially negotiate the scope of the subpoena if it thinks it can comply in some way without compromising its confidential news gathering activity. Or if the subpoena is overbroad or otherwise improper, they can go to court and try and quash it. And you know that in the subpoena first rule for documentary material, it highlights the intent of this law, right, to push law enforcement to the least intrusive means of investigating criminal activity that may implicate news gathering and journalists.
This is a statement from the Marion Police Department. They write this: the Federal Privacy Protection Act requires criminal investigators to get a subpoena instead of a search warrant when seeking work product materials and documentary materials from the press, except in circumstances, they write, including one, when there is reason to believe the journalist is taking part in the underlying wrongdoing. The Marion, Kansas Police Department believes it is the fundamental duty of the police to ensure the safety, security, and well-being of all members of the public. This commitment must remain steadfast and unbiased and unaffected by police or media influences in order to uphold the principles of justice, equal protection, and the rule of law for everyone in the community. The victim asks that we do all the law allows to ensure justice is served. They point to that exception when there is reason to believe the journalist is taking part in the underlying wrongdoing. And the police suspected that a journalist had conducted an unlawful search of a woman's driving under the influence record.
That's what, so they had cited to, in the search warrant that's been public, they had cited two state laws, identity theft and computer intrusion. And the facts, as we know them, and again, other facts could come out, were that the paper received a document. They received that document from a source, and then they verified information in that document on a publicly available state website. And then instead of publishing the information because of concern about its potential provenance or the motivation of the source and providing it, they went to the police. And then a couple of days later, you end up with this search. So I would say this. We acknowledged in our letter over the weekend the chief's acknowledgement that the PPA is meant to protect journalists. What I would say is that regardless of the legal theory that they may have had when they executed the search warrant, and regardless of the facts that they may have had in their hands at the time that they applied for the search warrant, it still should never have happened. These incidents are exceedingly rare. And I cannot think of a newsroom search that is as intrusive and as broad as this one, where they carted off the papers, computers, cell phones, documentary material, basically put it out of business. You know, were it not for the fact that lots of people in this country realize this is a real problem, a real threat to a free press, and they pitched in to make sure that the paper could put out its next edition this week.
That was Gabe Rotman of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the new C-SPAN Now mobile video app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.